Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Media in the studios of KAKM.
Hello and welcome to Alaska Edition. Today we'll be discussing the changing role of the military in Alaska. The state has unique training grounds and conditions, and that's no small part of why it hosts the kind of large-scale exercises we've seen this summer. But recently announced reductions in Army personnel at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson in the years ahead, as well as a growing focus on the Pacific Theater, are complicating Alaska's place in the military. We're joined by two guests to discuss where Alaska fits in the overall structure of the U.S. Armed Forces and how that could change in the years ahead. With us is Colonel Michael Forsyth, Chief of Staff for the Alaskan Command, in charge of overseeing activities for the 21,000 active duty military personnel in Alaska. And I do just want to note that while Colonel Forsyth's background is with the Army, and hence the Army uniform, his current position falls under the umbrella of Northern Command. So, Colonel, welcome. And I just want to make sure it's clear that you're not here as a representative of the Army, but of your purview is a little bit wider in terms of the integrated structure, correct?
That's correct. I'm the Chief of Staff of Alaskan Command, as you mentioned, which is a joint command. And what that means is that it contains Air Force, Army, Navy personnel, which manages the DOD enterprise, Department of Defense enterprise here in Alaska for Northern Command, which is in Colorado Springs.
Excellent. Thank you, sir. We're also joined by Bill Popp, President and CEO of the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation. AEDC was active earlier this year in making the case to the Joint Chiefs of Staff from the federal government why J-Bear is vital to Anchorage's economy and identity. In the weeks since, news came out that around 2,600 positions will be reduced from the 4th Brigade Combat Team's 25th Infantry Division. Mr. Popp and others have begun organizing to prepare for what this means for Anchorage. Welcome, Mr. Popp.
It's good to be here.
Thanks. And before we jump into today's conversation, I want to make sure that everyone has a sense of what we're talking about when it comes to military exercises. Because even though they're trainings, activities like airborne jumps from planes, artillery drills, launching jet fighters, these aren't simulated. It's been a busy summer for Alaska's military units stationed here with large-scale training exercises both in-state and abroad. And to give us a better sense of how those operations play out, KAKM's Monica Gokey has more on just one of those missions.
Only attack.
Every 2 years, forces from the Air Force, Army, Navy, Marines, and Coast Guard gather in Alaska for an exercise called Northern Edge. It's no small undertaking. More than 6,000 military personnel partake. The idea is to use the large training areas in South Central and the Gulf of Alaska to simulate large operations at sea. With the command center at J-Bear, fighter jets scramble over the Gulf to coordinate with Navy destroyers trying to locate and take out a submarine. An environmental impact statement allowed Northern Edge 2011 the use of up to 360 bombs, 66 missiles, and more than 25,000 Navy gun shells in the Gulf of Alaska. What was actually used this year was likely far less than that. But some Alaskans still prickle at whether or not this kind of mock warfare should even happen alongside Alaska wildlife. The $11 million exercise is a large-scale example of how Alaska's military resources and personnel fit within the broader mission of the armed forces. For KAKM, I'm Monica Gokey.
So, Colonel Forsyth, to start out, can you clarify what we do and don't know about how the pending drawdowns might affect Alaskan forces in the next few years? Because there's still a lot that's unknown, right?
There's quite a bit that's unknown. What we do know is that, as has been announced, the brigade, 4th Brigade of the 25th Infantry Division, which is an airborne brigade, will be reduced from a brigade size unit down to about a battalion task force size unit. So from where it is now at about 3,700 troopers down to about 1,050. Still an airborne capability which is deployable around the Pacific and other places, not just the Pacific, which we understand will have a great impact. Now, the leadership on J-Bear, our senior leaders there, are still trying to work through what the economic impact is inside the gate, outside the gate, and how that will affect our operations. And so as they learn more and in working with the community, we want to be fully transparent about that and make sure that we get the word out as to what the full impact is going to be when we've assessed it fully.
Is it difficult at all to have decisions being made kind of up the chain or elsewhere, and then also kind of still have the families and the lives that you're more familiar with and seeing on a day-to-day basis and kind of in direct communication with, raising questions about uncertainties?
Well, sure. Our job is, you know, if the strategic leaders make a decision, we're going to support that decision. They've done the analysis. They've determined where they want to assume some risk and where they want to support certain things. We have to support that. And then our job as the military leaders is to make sure that we take care of our families and assist them in the transition as well. I have a family of my own, and so it's important that we take care of them because really that family is what sustains us in doing our job and mission.
Mm-hmm. And switching gears just for a second to the city side, Mr. Pop, can you tell me about the BEAR Group? I think it's the Base Economic mm-hmm. and Analysis Review.
Right.
How it came to be and what the aims are?
Well, the BEAR Group is was formed by Anchorage Mayor Ethan Berkowitz as one of his first acts upon taking office, and is focused on trying to address the issues that he is not going to be directly addressing. He's seeking our advice and counsel on these what is a two-prong approach. The effort that he's going to be focusing on, specifically in partnership with our congressional delegation and the governor, is helping to try and change the minds of the military and through whatever means is appropriate and necessary that this decision shouldn't go forward and shouldn't be implemented. But in the meantime, we have to face the reality that this decision is currently the decision, and we have to start assessing what the economic impacts are going to be to the community, how we can respond to those impacts, how we can mitigate those impacts, and to focus on how we can work towards keeping as many of our friends and neighbors in the Army who are important members of our community right here in our community into the future.
So what are some of the tools that are in that toolbox as far as mitigating negative effects if the cuts go through?
Again, as the Colonel mentioned, this is early days. We don't know specifically what the makeup of the reduction is going to be in terms of who the troops are, because that's a wide and varied question, from enlisted troops to officers and command structure and how it's all going to be impacted, who's going to stay and who's going to leave. And then also the demographics of dependents, you know, how many are adults, how many are kids, impacts to the school district, impacts to the labor pool in terms, because many of these dependents are very important members of our business community in terms of being employees of any wide range of businesses in all walks of life. And it's going to take a while for us to understand that. And so the tools that we have, first of all, the BEAR Group, because it's going to bring together the different stakeholders as we identify them in the community, from Anchorage to Eagle River, and making sure that we have the right voices around the table, the right ideas, and the right points of view. The second piece is working with the U.S. Defense Department through the Office of Economic Adjustment, which Mayor Berkowitz has reached out and already contacted, and that the city administration is now in the process of applying for a research and mitigation grant that will do some of the preliminary research, help to fund those efforts so that we get good, clear data in partnership with the Army and with the military and the Alaskan Command, as well as the Department of Defense, in trying to pull all of the facts together instead of speculation or hopes and assumptions.
Right, thank you, and I don't mean to project onto you the role of a weatherman or an oracle peering into the ether and trying to conjure out a future. So at any
point.
It
happens all the time.
Okay. No, oracular Bill Pop here.
Yeah, there we go.
But Colonel, I want to turn back to you and just ask, what are some of the larger scale training exercises that we've seen this summer, and what's in store within the next year?
Well, as you've already displayed here, Northern Edge was the major training exercise for this summer, but we also have red flag exercises that are ongoing, which are air-centric, and it gives the Air Force the opportunity to simulate combat in the air and have a threat on the ground, which trains those pilots in how to operate in an austere environment and in a tough combat environment. In addition to that, next year we've got an exercise that's called Arctic Edge, and that exercise is in partnership with the state. It's a Northern Command-sponsored exercise, and it's going to focus on this coming year, on a cyber threat, which is, of course, we've seen a lot of that in the news lately, and that's very important to the state. And then 2 years ago, this is an every two-year exercise on even-numbered years. 2 years ago, the exercise focused on how the DOD could assist the state in the event of another major earthquake, because that that exercise in 14 was around the anniversary of the Good Friday earthquake. And so DOD provides a great deal of support when we are asked and authorized to the state in recovering from disasters and during emergencies. And so that's a major one that we do coming up next year.
And these large training exercises, how do they vary in both their scale and their frequency from some of the smaller stuff that's always going on around base? I'm thinking, you know, in East Anchorage, I'm always seeing F-22s flying over, or there's notices about noise ordinances for artillery training.
Right. Well, it depends on scope and scale. Of course, we train from the smallest unit, the squad level, the air crew level, all the way up to the major exercises where we bring the entire joint team, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines together to train. So the small scale, for example, is you mentioned an artillery unit. I am an artilleryman. Will go out and they have to do certain steps of training in order to maintain proficiency. And that is very low-cost training because it's a single-service, small unit. Some of the other things you see that are going on around with the F-22s that you mentioned are a combination of routine training, but also you have combat air patrols that are maintaining our air sovereignty around the state of Alaska. And those are routine things that have to happen. Now, when you stair step up to the larger scale operations, those are all about being able to provide command control of large scale, complex operations, which if we don't practice, we're not going to be very good at. When you bring Marines and Navy and Air Force and Army together, we don't work together all the time, so you got to do that periodically in order to maintain readiness, because that's what we're asked to do by our government.
Mm-hmm. It was interesting to me during Northern Edge to see that some of the stuff that was happening was just people becoming familiar with each other's terms.
Well, absolutely. You know, in fact, one of the things we like to use is interoperability. Although even Army units that wear the same uniform have to get together and build relationships and understand how we're going to operate when we reach a battlefield. God forbid we have to do that. Because if the first time we're learning about each other is when we get to the battlefield, that's way too late and we're not going to be ready for what we're asked to do. So that's why we do exercises across the spectrum from the lowest level to the highest to ensure we're ready.
And the number that I've heard the most in the last few weeks is 2,600. I feel like that's sort of a placeholder. If I understand correctly, it's the 2,631 troops from the 425th that'll be reduced. But Mr. Pop, I want to ask you, what's behind that number? Because that doesn't account for spouses, dependents, or some of the civilian jobs that were already in line to be cut. So without risking sounding callous, is there a kind of economic number in terms of incomes or salaries that you're anticipating losing by the end of these 3 years?
It's still speculative, so I want to make that really, really clear. And we're being very, very careful not to get out in front of the military in any kind of wild speculation about the impacts, because there are people's lives that are going to be affected by the decisions that are being made over the next several months. And we don't want to create undue uncertainty with the civilian workforce, with the dependents, et cetera. So what I'm going to bring forward is just some basic numbers that we understand them. One is the 2,600 active duty military personnel that are going to be affected by the decisions. How they're going to be affected, I can't speak to. I know that the Department of Defense press release notes attrition as being a key tool for the force reduction, meaning troops reaching the end of their term in terms of their hitch, if you will. And then the number that we've been given to as an initial estimate is approximately 3,500 dependents. Now, we don't know what the makeup is of those dependents. How many are kids, how many are adults, et cetera. But when you put those two numbers together, it's a little over 6,000 people that are going to be potentially affected by this decision, who are currently our friends and neighbors here in Anchorage. And so when we look at that number, that has, you know, some impact in terms of the economy. It is not without pain if we lose that many people from the economy. We're a city of 300,000. So it's approximately in the neighborhood of about 2% of our overall current population. It's not the by any means a depression initiating decision. We're not trying to say that, but it is definitely going to have an effect on businesses, on to a much smaller degree the housing market, given how tight the housing market is, and some other economic consequences that we still don't totally understand.
You've said a lot there that I'm very interested in, and now I'm carefully trying to pick where to follow up. So
okay.
We'll come back, I think, to the question of real estate in just
okay.
a second. But before we do, Colonel, I wonder if you can tell me a little bit about the 20 to 25,000 active duty troops that are here. Where do they fit in the big picture of the armed forces mission, both globally and then nationally, especially with more attention towards the Pacific, the Arctic, and then cooling relations with Russia?
Well, one of the things you mentioned is the Pacific, the Arctic, and Russia. Alaska is really the nexus point in geography for many important regions of the world. And so the focus of the troops here truly is global because troops can deploy from here to anywhere in the world more rapidly than they can, and not anywhere in the world, anywhere in the Northern Hemisphere. More rapidly from Alaska than they can from anywhere in the continental United States. People, when you look at a map of Alaska, many times if it's a flat map, you see Alaska way up in the corner up here of a flat map. But if you use a round globe and turn that globe up towards the Northern Hemisphere, you notice that Alaska is kind of in the center of the Northern Hemisphere. And so that is important because when you station troops and airmen here, they can rapidly get to a trouble spot when they're needed. Now also, in addition, Alaska makes us an Arctic nation, and the troops and airmen here have the unique capabilities and are the experts for the Department of Defense in Arctic specialization. We're regaining some of those skills because we've been at war in another place here for the past decade and a half. But we're relearning that skills because we have to deliver that skill set back to the Department of Defense if needed. But Alaska, because of its unique position, is an excellent place to move troops to trouble spots. And also, you know, we have to defend our sovereignty here too, because we really are the forward edge of the frontier for the United States. And so we take that mission with a lot of responsibility and cognizant of its importance.
I want to just ask one thing about that flight capability, because I hear that claim championed a lot, and I actually got to see it in action earlier this year with a battalion from the 425th Spartan Brigade when they went down to Australia for Northern Edge on these big C-130s and were parachuting down within 24 hours of leaving. I think it was about 19 hours between when they took off and they jumped. Mm-hmm. Very impressive. But again, that was for training, and I guess I'm curious how much of the capability here is hypothetical and how much is operational and actually fits into critical missions that are currently happening across the globe.
Well, we always train for operations. I mean, that's the purpose of that. Paratroops are early entry forces that allow you to gain a foothold and then bring other forces in to expand your footprint in accordance with our national interests. But let me give you a quick example of some operationalization of some paratroops just recently. And these were actually Air Force paratroops. You probably heard about a big typhoon that went across Wake Island recently. They had to evacuate all the personnel that were on Wake Island to Guam as the typhoon passed through. Well, we don't know what damage that typhoon caused to the infrastructure that was there. And one of the ways that they were able to assess the damage and if they could land a plane to bring the people back to Wake Island was they dropped some paratroops. These were Air Force folks that actually got onto the runway, got to the infrastructure, and examined it and made an assessment that was then brought back to let people know, hey, the people can come back. So not only is this operational capability in combat, it also has a peacetime application. And so it's critically important for our nation to maintain that capability.
All right, thank you, because it often seems like unless people are having in mind, the paratrooping into France in 1944, that there hasn't been a real airborne operation since.
But that's a very recent example, but airborne troops were used in Iraq As well, in 2003, the 173rd Airborne Brigade did do a parachute drop into northern Iraq. As the audience may recall, the 4th Infantry Division was supposed to come from the north out of Turkey. When we were denied that access, the only way to get troops in on the ground in northern Iraq and secure anything was paratroops. And so that's another fairly recent example, although it was 12, 13 years ago now.
Well, taking a break from northern Iraq and the Pacific for just a second to East Anchorage and Eagle River, I want to ask about real estate because it does seem like there's a little bit of uncertainty right now in the neighborhoods around the base. And I guess Mayor Berkowitz was on the show last week when asked, you know, are we in a recession in Anchorage? He just gave the most flat, unequivocal no. You just mentioned that, you know, this isn't enough to disrupt Anchorage's entire economy, but I wonder if some of the neighborhoods that are close and where there is a higher rate of rent and ownership over homes, whether those might be effective in a large but local way.
Absolutely, and we recognize that. There is going to be some localized impacts, but again, we don't fully understand them. We know that there are a substantial number of troops from the Army side of J-Bear who live off base. Where do they live? We don't know all of the data on that. Are they in Northeast Anchorage? Are they in Eagle River? Are they in the Mat-Su? Are they elsewhere in Anchorage, such as Midtown or down or Southside? We don't know. There, yes, it's a definite military neighborhood in and around the gates of J-Bear. And yes, those businesses and those properties are going to be affected. But again, we don't know what the degree it's going to be an impact on those neighborhoods. What we are looking at, though, is the broader housing market. And we know that overall in the Anchorage housing market, rental market is very tight, less than 4% vacancy rate, still on the oversubscribed side of the equation. The single-family home market is incredibly tight. We're seeing average single-family home sale prices so far this year approaching the 370s in terms of the average sales price of a home in the second quarter. That's a substantial bump up from where we were just 5 years ago. There is going to be an effect on the housing market. If anything, it might create, in the initial opinion of some of the developers and realtors that we've spoken to, more of a transitory buyer's market opportunity, if you will, but not any kind of recessionary or depressionary influence on the housing market, at least not that we can identify yet.
To somebody that were just to tongue-in-cheek kind of ask, so will this solve the housing shortage?
It will not. It will not even come close. We are substantially underbuilt in Anchorage, which is why we are seeing such high housing prices and low vacancy rates in our rental market. And there is a lot of room for improvement. There is a backlog of demand that we think will carry beyond this situation that we're currently dealing with the force reduction.
And I want to ask about Tikatnu Commons, because that to me seems like a project that hinges on a lot of, you know, a healthy base status. Has that been brought into question since the announcement that there would be some downsizing?
You know, we haven't had direct conversations with the retailers in that area, nor the property owners, Siri. But I can tell you that property is a major retail center, not only that predicates its market not only on the military base, but on Anchorage, on Eagle River, on the Valley. It's a major shopping hub, as is Glen Square, as is the Northway Mall. They all have their markets. And again, we have to keep this into context. This is just a hair under 2% of Anchorage's population. When you throw in the Mat-Su borough to add to that mix another 100 plus thousand people, it drops the impact, if you were to think of it in that size of a population, of less than 1%.
And this is a question for either one of you, but I am curious if there's a precedent for what's happening now, because I sometimes feel that the news can make it seem as if we're teetering on the verge of economic disaster should these 2,600 positions go away. And I'm curious what the base realignment and closure process was like in the 90s and how that affected things, and any other drawdowns from the past that give us a little bit of a historical model for understanding what we're in for, or is it apples and oranges?
Well, I was around in the 90s during the base realignment at that time. And I would tell you it depends based on community. A small community obviously is going to be more affected than a larger community with any kind of realignment. But I would tell you that I think that that the cooperation between the military here and the Anchorage community, which, by the way, I've been stationed in 12 different states during my career. If this is not the best, it's one of the top two that I've seen in my military career for support. And the way that the military also works with the local community. Working together, we can really mitigate this. And there's examples of that mitigation during the 90s that occurred in communities that really worked with the military in mitigating the effect of losses. So this can work. It's just going to take planning and cooperation, quite frankly.
And Mr. Pop, about 15, 20 seconds, if you have anything to add.
I think that what we've got is a city that supports the military, as we showed at the Rally for the Troops back in February. Over 1,000 citizens showed up, over 500 stayed for the hearing. I think what's been stated already is clearly the message that we want to impart, that there's a level of cooperation that I think exists here that you won't find in any other city.
Well, that's all the time we have today on Alaska Edition. Thank you to both of my guests, Colonel Michael Forsyth, the Chief of Staff for Alaskan Command, and Bill Popp, President and CEO of the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation. And thank you at home for joining us. I'm Zachariah Hughes.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.